only with plastic-wrapped A4 sheets printed with memos and motivational messages from HR. An intermittently working light bulb hung from a cable on the ceiling, and a cockroach's shadow skittered on the floorboards. They reached the back of the store and cleared a space on the table near the water cooler. Omar grabbed an old mouse, then connected the laptop to an outlet. While it booted up, Lisa took a quick peek at the front. Mark seemed to be doing okay. At least the store wasn't on fire, which was all anyone had a right to expect. They made eye contact across the phone case rows. Lisa gave him a grimace, and Mark gestured up at Ryan's office and mouthed something foul before hurrying to the register.
"What's the password?" Omar asked when she returned.
She sat next to the kid, who tensed up at her closeness and glanced at her out of the corner of his eye. Lisa pretended not to notice and turned her chair to an angle to put a bit more distance between them, playing it off as getting a better look at the screen.
"Let's see," she said. "System 04, all lowercase, a zero before the four, no spaces."
Omar typed the password under the username, which was Ed W. It was a small miracle that Ryan hadn't tossed the damn laptop away. After Ed's mysterious disappearance, Ryan had searched his workstation in case it hid any clue as to Ed's whereabouts. But despite Ryan's hopes, it turned out that life didn't work like a mystery movie. The laptop only contained work-related data, Ed's work email, Ivalis Online, and a pair of flash games that Ryan used as further evidence of Ed's malicious incompetence. Lisa recalled Ryan's disappointed frown with a small smile of her own.
"What did you expect to find? A terabyte of scandalous porn, his new address, and a written confession? Every one of your employees is computer literate, dude."
The desktop took several painful minutes to load. Then it showed a black background and a sparse spread of icons. Omar took a few seconds to find IO's pixel art icon on the screen and double-clicked it with an eager grin.
"I've been reading up on this game," he told Lisa while the .exe loaded. "I wanted to download it into my own PC, but there's no official download link anywhere, only cracked single-player versions."
"Yeah, we've talked about it on the forums," Lisa said.
Despite it all, she couldn't stay away from a bit of game-related gossip.
"Apparently, the devs stopped answering mails or calls without explanation and took down their site a few years ago. No one knows why. The game has a rabid fan base, so they would have bought anything new the devs launched."
After a black loading screen, the words Pantheon appeared in golden letters, along with an audio file, like the metallic sound of drawing a sharp sword in a movie.
"These are the devs?" Omar asked.
"That's right. Weird bunch, you know. Ed and Mark loved them because they were so quirky, but I think that's the reason the game never took off in the first place. They added dozens of limitations that made no sense, all in the name of immersion. But they made the game unplayable unless you're really trying to get into it."
"To be honest, I'm even more curious now."
"You'll see what I mean."
After the Pantheon screen came the usual legalese, a warning that the game wasn't appropriate for children, and a disclaimer that the devs weren't responsible for the shit players did to each other while in-game. Then came a pixelated introductory video about the single-player campaign's main character fighting hordes of bad guys while a narrator rambled on in the background about justice and destiny. The CGI had aged terribly, but Lisa found that it only added to the game's charm. When the video was done, a start screen took its place, with the Good Kingdom's castle in the background, besieged by hordes of the evil empire. On the right side of the screen appeared a list and a medieval typeset. Campaign, Ivalis Online, Options, Forums, Account, Exit. Omar clicked on Ivalis Online, which filled the left side of the screen with another menu. It was divided into four rectangles which had a character portrait in each of them, with bars showing their names, stats, levels, and hours played. Each character was a different level. The one on the right, an elven wizard, was the strongest and had the longest playtime, and the one on the left was a rookie warrior with only a few hours played.
"On a fresh account," Lisa explained, "you can only have one character at a time. Apparently, Pantheon wanted us to prove we were worthy of the responsibility to keep more characters. So we have to unlock more slots by killing bosses and the like."
"I've played games that do that," Omar pointed out. "Nothing weird about it." Lisa grinned.
It's in the way they frame the reward. Think about it. Most games IO's age pretend the players are the characters to maintain immersion. Player characters are the ones killing the baddies and finding the loot. But IO rewards the players themselves and keeps talking at them the entire time. If you have a careless playstyle and keep killing your characters, the game scolds you and may take features away in punishment. There are even a few guys who got banned from the multiplayer version because they died too much.
Okay, now that's strange, Omar said. Not even EA does that.
It pissed off some of the fanbase, but most only shrugged and told the angry ones to get good.
Omar snorted. Sounds about right.
So, let's get you started on the campaign first, okay? It's an extended tutorial. After you're done, you can delete the two weakest characters and make your own.
Omar left the Ivalis online menu and hovered over the campaign, which showed the options for new game and continue. Are you sure this guy won't get pissed I'm messing with his account? He tapped at the laptop stickers.
Well, he hasn't logged on in a while, so he's probably moved on by now,
Lisa said, trying to keep her voice level. She had always wondered how well Laser Shark security cameras could pick up audio, because Ryan had the tendency to show up at exactly the worst times.
To be honest, Ed's a touchy subject around here. I wouldn't mention him if I were you.
I heard bits of gossip here and there, Omar went on, oblivious to Lisa's discomfort. He's the guy who lost it, isn't he? The one who attacked Mr. Ryan and ran away from the police? Crazy fucker, am I right?
Lisa glanced at the corner where she knew the security camera lurked.
Sure,
she said.
Whatever.
Technically, Ryan's story was right. Ed had lost it, no question about it. She had been raised to find violence unacceptable under any circumstance. Still, Lisa couldn't shake the feeling that Ryan had pruned his version until it showed only one side of the tale. He hadn't mentioned the constant verbal abuse, for example. Still, did that justify smashing someone's face against a desk? Lisa felt a pang of guilt in her chest, and she shook her head to clear it. She'd spent a year barely thinking about Ed and his assertive, "I quit, Ryan," delivery. But Omar couldn't help but bring it up over and over, and she was sure it was awakening Ryan's old grudges. Lisa would have very much preferred he didn't, primarily because before he'd made a target out of Ed, he'd focused his nastiness on her. Her hand gripped her jeans.
Yes, that's the real problem, isn't it?
She thought, angry at herself. Not even Omar could miss the meaning of a whatever, so he shrugged and returned his attention to the screen, which was fine by her. Clicking on the new game option prompted two "Are you sure?" text boxes, and then a new video began. It told the story of the Good Kingdom, a peaceful and prosperous land that had lived in harmony for generations, which had earned them the jealousy of the Evil Empire.
Evil Empire?
Omar asked, looking at the screen as if someone was pranking him.
Good Kingdom? Who the hell came up with these names?
I think it's supposed to be tongue-in-cheek and self-aware of the tropes,
Lisa said, getting defensive like any gamer who finds her favorite game being even slightly criticized.
Anyway, the story is mostly an excuse to kill shit, and Pantheon's mechanics are way ahead of their time. So who cares if their campaign abuses all the fantasy cliches around?
Okay, I get it,
said Omar, raising his open palms in surrender.
Tongue-in-cheek it is.
The Evil Empire had sent a terrible curse called the Culling upon the Good Kingdom. During the Culling, the Evil Empire's agents had killed thousands of the Good Kingdom's people, burned their cities, and salted their fields. The wise King Varen suffered nobly for weeks while the evil armies grew in strength and prepared for the final strike. Until a brave young man heard the call of destiny, grabbed his sword, and bravely set to rally the forces of good into a desperate attack to retaliate against the Culling and bring the fight into the Evil Empire's lands. Along with his three plucky companions, of course. At that point in the video, the screen zoomed from the hero's village into his home, bypassed the straw roof, and showed his silhouette sleeping in bed as one of his companions ran into his room, bellowing for him to wake up, since he was already late to his meeting with the village elders. The hero rose, and a character creation menu deftly replaced the cutscene with no obvious loading screen.
Neat, said Omar.
Not bad for a 15-year-old game, right?
Lisa asked proudly.
So, what's the story about?
Without spoiling much, you assemble your squad, fight a couple minor bad guys terrorizing the Good Kingdom, level up, then travel to the Evil Empire to confront the big bad, Zalos or something like that.
She left out the tragic betrayal at the midpoint of the campaign, or the bittersweet ending with the player character's heroic sacrifice.
Okay, seems pretty straightforward.
The multiplayer takes place after the campaign,
Lisa went on.
You're supposed to help the Good Kingdom finish off the baddies. The main goal is to hunt down this Everbleed guy. He's in the campaign as well. Starts as a minor boss, but takes over when you deal with the big bad.
The character creation let Omar play with the hero's name, stats, class, and appearance. The placeholder name was Dasius, which Omar replaced, in a dashing display of creativity, with Omar. He then began changing Dasius's appearance into his own likeness. Lisa knew some people could spend more time customizing their characters than actually playing the game, so she went for a drink of water, then checked on Mark again. He was talking to a customer dressed in an expensive black suit, a tall man partially hidden by a signboard displaying the newest overpriced Ethernet cable. Mark kept throwing quizzical glances at the back, then nodding, but he seemed to be doing fine. The rest of the store was empty, which was a bit strange, but Lisa chalked it up to the rest of the crew timing their break. As long as they came back soon, Ryan wouldn't notice. Probably.
That's how you survive, isn't it?
She told herself, breaking her train of thought.
You keep your head down, make yourself small, and hope your problems don't notice you. The only reason you're stuck here is because there's a fight waiting for you, yet you refuse to fight it.
It all had started. Well, like in Omar's case. She had been a new hire, and Ryan had seemed like the dream boss. Attractive, charming, and relaxed. If Lisa hadn't been dating a tattoo artist a couple blocks away... Goosebumps traveled down her back.
That's one hell of a bullet dodged,
she thought. Ryan had flirted playfully with her at the beginning. Nothing serious, just friendly banter. Or so she'd thought. She'd made it clear she wasn't available, but wasn't too insistent over it. Later, her younger sister had told her that had been a mistake and that she should have been sterner, that guys like Ryan use even the slightest opening to stick their foot in the door and act pissed when you tried to close it. Lisa and her sister had argued quite a lot over that analysis. Lisa believed that it was insane to try to control everyone's interpretations of her every action. It wasn't fair or even possible. Her sister seemed to pull it off without effort, though. Diana had just graduated and had already landed a rock star internship in a promising marketing startup, thanks to her makeup tutorial vlog with 3 million followers. She was also the kind of person that claimed that her pay-to-win smartphone energy timer game made her hardcore into gaming. In the end, Lisa had rejected Ryan's advances, and he hadn't taken nicely to it. His personality had taken a total U-turn, going from charming and straight into "you're an ugly cow" territory, and he then proceeded to make her life a living hell while she unsuccessfully looked for another job. Then Ed had come along, a lanky nerd who had, for some reason or another, redirected Ryan's attention and ire to himself.
And here you are again,
she thought,
hoping that someone else takes the fall instead of your sorry ass. When will you learn to fight your own fights, Liz?
The room had turned a strange shade of white. Surprised, Lisa propped herself against the wall and took deep, steadying breaths.
Are you okay?
Omar asked, looking up from his laptop.
You're looking a bit pale.
Sure.
Lisa stammered, barely paying any attention to him. Her head was pulsating something fierce, sending red jolts of pain through her nervous system in the rhythm of a heartbeat. On a whim, she turned to the register, half expecting to see an unearthly creature smiling at her beneath a signboard. But Mark was alone, and the bell by the door at the front chimed as someone closed it. Mark turned to her with a quizzical expression. He had a black letter in his hand. Was someone singing in the distance? Lisa shook her head again and fought the urge to clasp her forehead.
Actually, do you have any aspirin?
She asked Omar. The air reeked of pungent chemicals and rotten fruit.
No, Omar said. But I could call Mr. Ryan and ask—
Forget it,
Lisa said, waving her hand.
It was nothing.
She forced herself to straighten her back and fake a smile.
I bit my tongue, that's all.
Before Omar had a chance to reply, she strolled out toward the front, acting as if nothing was wrong. Mark saw her and waved her over.
Hey, Liz! You wouldn't believe what just happened,
he told her with an uncertain grin.
Funny you mention that,
she said. But Mark wasn't listening. He held the black letter in front of her.
This is for you, he said. From a headhunting company, or something like that. The dude just left and wasn't very clear, but it seems like you got a job offer.
Lisa grabbed the letter without thinking. Her mind had gone blank with surprise. As her headache receded, the feeling of incoming doom that had almost overwhelmed her went away as well. She'd almost expected Mark to tell her that her house had burned down. A letter from a headhunter company was completely out of left field. She wasn't even aware her resume was still out there, or that anyone was looking at it.
Weird, isn't it? I told him you were working in the back, but he said the timing wasn't right and just left.
Lisa scrutinized the card. It had her full name and address on it, and the sender put simply, Mr. K. Possier, headhunter.
Yeah, it's pretty strange,
she said, eyeing Mr. Possier's handwriting with distrust. If it was a joke, it'd be a cruel one, which was exactly the kind of humor that Ryan favored most.
Well, even if it is, there's nothing lost by looking, right?
Mark told her. He shrugged. Mark was a good guy and a solid friend, but his attention span could use a few extra skill ranks.
So, what do you think about the new guy? Will he be ready to do some questing soon?
Lisa glanced back. The glow of the laptop reflected on Omar's glasses while his hands danced across the keyboard and mouse.
Perhaps some low-level jobs until he's done with the campaign. We could get him to main Ed's wizard, but there's no chance in hell he won't fuck up until he figures out what he's doing.
If Omar led them to a party wipe, Ryan would show him his true colors fast enough, which would only add to Lisa's guilt about hiding behind the new hire. In a messed-up way, helping the new kid do well was a way for Lisa to redeem herself.
I doubt our brave leader will have the patience to stick with low-level quests, Mark pointed out.
He then raised an eyebrow while glancing at a point past Lisa's shoulder.
Oh, speaking of, time to go look busy by that corner over there, I guess.
Ryan came down the stairs of his office and stopped a few feet away from Omar. The two of them chatted amiably for a while. Ryan seemed very pleased with himself for some reason, which only added to Lisa's growing worry about the letter being a prank from him. But Ryan barely looked her way. Instead, he clapped Omar on the back and pointed at the front door. Omar smiled, closed the laptop, and grabbed his jacket. Lisa frowned and headed back, wondering if Ryan had finally lost it.
What's going on?
She asked.
Oh, Lisa, there you are, Ryan said. I was just telling our friend Omar here he could take the day off and practice his skills. It's a slow day, after all. No need to kid ourselves. I'm sure that between Mark, you, and me, we can keep the store running no problem. Just don't make a habit out of gaming on the job, okay?
This last part he said to Omar, winking as he did.
Sure, boss, you've got it,
Omar said, grinning knowingly while, at the same time, completely missing the point. It reminded Lisa of a lamb heading happily to the slaughterhouse, thinking it was about to be fed. After the kid had left, Lisa turned to Ryan.
Only us three? Where's the rest of the crew?
She asked.
Ah, I told them to take the day off as well.
Ryan's grin grew a few inches, and Lisa had the glaring suspicion that she'd just fallen straight into some kind of trap.
After all, it isn't fair that they have to work hard all day while others get to sit on their ass neglecting their duties and playing video games, don't you think?
What else do you expect people to sit on instead of their ass?
Lisa thought. But that kind of attitude was Diana's domain, not hers. What she said instead was,
"But you told Omar he could. Why punish him for something you told him to do?"
Ryan brandished an admonishing finger.
"What makes you think I was speaking about him?"
he asked, smiling cruelly.
"No, I was talking about you, Lisa. Who gave you the right to sit around while others pick up your slack, I wonder? That's always been your problem, you know. I mean, other than being too plain. It's your personality. People can just tell you think you're better than us."
If he'd sprouted wings and a beak, Lisa would have been about as dumbfounded as she was now. She could only stare at him in disbelief and mumble a miserable,
"What?"
"At this rate, I'll be forced to note your lack of team spirit in this month's performance review."
What little extra over minimum wage Lisa earned was set as a bonus for good performance that Laser Shark Corporate delivered monthly. In other words, Ryan had decided to dock her wage on a whim.
"Lucky for you, I'm an amazing boss. I'm probably too permissive, but I'll reconsider your review if you close the store on your own this weekend. You think you can manage that without screwing up?"
At that moment, Lisa realized several things. The first was that it was the beginning of summer. The second was that Ryan was dressed for going out. The third was that he'd set her up only because he wanted to bail for the weekend without admitting it. She could feel the texture of the black letter under her fingertips. Even the paper felt expensive and exclusive. It was the kind of letter that Ryan would receive, not her. Her hand gripped the paper a bit too tightly, as if clutching to a lifeline as she drowned in the ocean.
"I'll do my best,"
she said blankly, as she marched for the broom closet.
"Have a nice trip,"
she called over her shoulder. Her words carried just a hint of mockery. Her attitude surprised even herself. Perhaps she had more of Diana in her than she'd like to admit.
"You better," Ryan said. "And watch that attitude, Lisa. Hot girls can get away with that, but it just makes you look like an ass. All right?"
Lisa opened the closet and buried her face inside so he wouldn't see her roll her eyes.
"Fucking asshole,"
she whispered. Was that the best he could come up with? At first glance, the letter didn't seem to be one of Ryan's jokes. Which was all the better, because Lisa was sure she'd have gone murderously insane if it were. On the other hand, there was no guarantee it wasn't some kind of idiotic, or even dangerous, scam. Whatever it was, it definitely wasn't a conventional job offer. Dear Lisa, do you find yourself stuck? Has your life turned stale? We can offer you hope. How would you like to have an entire world at the grasp of your fingertips? This is a new chance to get things right, to get the respect you deserve. All this can be yours if you prove yourself worthy of working with us. You have a glowing recommendation, and we only need proof that you've got what it takes to excel in a highly competitive environment. We'll be watching you with great interest. Yours, Mr. K. Possier. The Dark. There were no directions, and no number or email for her to contact. There was no mention of what she was supposed to do. Not even pyramid schemes were this cheeky. Lisa reread those few lines repeatedly, her confusion growing by the second. What kind of job offer was that? We'll be watching you? That sounded more like a threat than anything else. She shuddered and hid the letter in the pocket of her apron as she carried the cleaning instruments out of the closet. We can offer you hope. For a while now, she realized, she'd given up on hope. She'd even stopped looking for a new job. The worst part about the deranged letter was the implication that they were, indeed, giving her hope, despite her desperate attempts to quench it. And what kind of company named itself The Dark, anyway?
Chapter 17.
Branching Endings. Levy's laboratory was a two-story circular chamber covered in shadows and cobwebs, filled to the brim with strange devices and dusty pieces of furniture. Ed and Kleck navigated through a maze-like series of shelves and bookcases that rose up to the ceiling. Leathery tomes loomed above Ed as he went, and small animal skulls hung in groups of three from the ceiling, with tiny fragments of magical torches burning from inside and setting the empty sockets ablaze with menacing fire. Kleck took one look at Levy's decorations and shivered.
"Scary ladies live in scary homes," he muttered to himself.
Near a corner, a centipede as long and thick as a human arm skittered out of sight. "At this point," Ed told the spider rider, "I'm sure that she does it because her witch apparel gives bonuses to her hex magic."
"Is that true?"
Kleck asked, his eyes widening. Ed shrugged apologetically. "It would explain a lot of things." They found Levy sitting on a cramped workbench, partially hidden by a stack of parchment rolls, several menacing brass contraptions, and a mercurial magic ball as big as her head. She was resting her head between her arms and didn't acknowledge their presence. Next to her arms on the table was a huge human skull, which was missing several teeth and was cracked in several places.
"Levy?" Ed asked.
Levy sniffed and jerked to her feet, her hands crackling with sparks of hex energy.
"Dunghill!"
she exclaimed, blinking several times as the energy dissipated.
"Ed! Didn't anyone tell you to knock? You scared me."
Ed and Kleck exchanged a confused glance. Levy looked like hell. Her hair was a frizzy, tangled mess, her eyes were sunken, and oily liquid stained her purple dress.
"The Batlin said you had something to show us," Ed told the witch. "Perhaps we should come by later?"
Levy blinked again.
"Ah, of course. I called for you."
She gave them one of her famous Levy grins.
"You'll want to take a look at this. Lavina's amazing genius triumphs again."
She rested a hand over the cracked skull and bent forward, smiling like a madwoman.
"Remember the lenses quest? I've made huge progress on it. There is now a working prototype."
Kleck looked at Levy, then at the skull.
Is that the prototype?" he asked.
"Oh, this? No, little guy, this is a personal project of mine."
She patted the skull distractedly, with something akin to fondness in her expression.
"It's a trophy, like Ed's in the war room. It belonged to a guy named Rollum. He was a very strong son of a bitch, built like a minotaur. I want to raise his spirit and put it inside a golem, to see if that could somehow improve the golem's physical stats."
If anything, Kleck seemed more confused. Levy pursed her lips and straightened her back.
"The prototype, right. Follow me, guys, and prepare to be amazed."
She led them past a huge stone oven embedded in the wall, which was surrounded with iron shelves and tables strewn with pots filled with clay dust and crystal vials full of bubbling liquids. Near a corner, a huge crystal dish hung from the ceiling by a pair of thick ropes. It was as big as Ed's torso, and it seemed to be engraved on the inside with an array of fine brass and copper lines that vaguely reminded Ed of circuitry. Levy stood proudly next to the dish and beamed.
"Isn't it amazing? I did it myself. I mean, with a bit of help from drone transmutation, of course."
Ed walked closer to the dish to study the engravings. Upon closer inspection, he was sure the shapes traced by the connections between the lines reminded him of the glyphs often found in a rune.
"Levy, this is great work, but when did you find the time?"
"Well, a witch has her ways,"
Levy said. Ed was sure he saw a faint twitch in her left eyelid.
"When was the last time you slept, scary lady?"
Kleck asked her, his ears straightened with concern. Levy grimaced.
3 minutes ago. Not that you should care. The haunt cannot afford to lose 8 hours of my mind every night."
"Didn't you say once that not sleeping makes people age faster?"
Kleck asked.
"Well,"
she said, then pursed her lips.
"You want to see what the damn thing does or not?"
Just promise us you'll take a nap afterward, okay? Don't push yourself too hard," Ed told her.
The witch made a vague, non-committal gesture with her arm, and then rummaged through the ribbons of her dress until she found a small trinket. She held it up for Ed and Kleck to see. It was Zachary's looking glass, the one that had failed to stop Yarlin's hypnotic gaze.
Warlock Jason once told me that, with spellcraft, you can learn more by studying someone's mistakes than from their successes. Well, more like he mumbled it to himself while he worked, and I happened to be in the room.
She frowned.
So, the first step of my quest was to ask myself, why did this lens fail? Simple. Zachary and Brett are not spellcasters.
She raised one finger.
Sure, Zachary can cast a few spells, because he's a priest, but that's not the same thing. A spellcaster is a trained specialist who knows the theory of magic. There's a world of difference between using something and knowing how it works. In this case, Zachary simply assumed that by piling a bunch of minor divine blessings on a glass, it would be enough to counter Yarlin's spell. That's a common misunderstanding of magical theory. So, of course, it instantly unraveled when tested. It would be like throwing a splash of water and a piece of ham into a pot and hoping for stew.
Ed decided not to point out that she hadn't voiced any complaints about Zachary's experiments either. He knew that Levy's self-esteem was more fragile than she let on, so he let small details like that pass. As long as she wasn't a dick about it, like she'd been when they first met.
You need a fire to make a stew. The ingredients need to meld together, or you'll create a useless mess.
Levy went on, gesturing with her fingers over Zachary's trinket like a chef working on a dish.
Same thing with spellcraft. To create an enchanted object, it isn't enough to just throw a spell on top and call it a day. You need the fire that melds the magic and the object.
She pointed at the brass lines inside her giant version of the lens.
I made these using the engrave rune talent. You're looking at an enlarged version of the inside of a rune, actually. The reason it had to be so big, well, it's because engrave rune is designed to work with runic stone, not with glass. But I'm sure I can make smaller versions with more practice.
She traced the path of one brass line with her fingertip.
A rune is created by mixing engrave rune with the spell you want to use to charge the rune. Engrave lets you design the artificial ley lines, and the spell both shapes the lines and powers them with enough magical charge to use the spell. In this, craft imitates life, because the body of a magic user works in much the same way. All living creatures have a system of biological ley lines inside ourselves. Some clerics believe this is our soul. Pouring experience points into the spellcasting talent allows these ley lines to develop, to grow in complexity so we can, in turn, cast more complex spells. What we call basic types, and later improved, advanced, heroic, and so on. To power each spell, the ley lines use the body's internal magic supply, which replenishes every day as long as you're well-fed and well-rested. This supply is limited by your size and your species, of course, which is why we can cast only one or two spells when we start our training. It only grows when upgrading your talent past the basic type. But, with practice, we can teach our body to be more efficient in its use of our supply, so we can cast more spells with the same amount of energy. That's what increasing the spellcasting skill does.
She finished her explanation and crossed her arms, looking proud.
She has a right to be, Ed thought.
She was a world ahead of the apprentice she'd been when they'd first met, both of them confused and barely understanding what was going on around them. It was amazing to see the speed at which she was learning, now that she had the right tools and a nurturing environment for her self-esteem to develop. Almost immediately, he realized as well that she, and Alder and Kes and the rest of the haunt, had done the exact same thing for him, with no one realizing it.
Still with me?
Levy asked. Kleck glanced at his belly, then at the giant dish, as if expecting to find the ley lines growing out of him like vines. He nodded dubiously.
Sure, Levy, Ed said. And thanks for the lesson. You've taught me a lot today.
She beamed at him.
I was worried I was talking too much.
She patted her dish again.
So, how about a little practical test? The dish is engraved with a specific counter for your minor order spell, Ed. Since the ley lines are built as a countermeasure, they need no charge. But they only work on that specific spell. Let's give it a try, all right?
Before either of them could raise any objections, Levy had already ushered them into place. Kleck stood with his back to the wall, staring nervously at Ed past the softly swaying crystal of the glass between them. The dish's surface slightly distorted the Batlin's figure.
This should be pretty straightforward,
Levy advised.
Ed, simply cast Minor Order on Kleck. Kleck, if my lens works, you shouldn't even have to pass a spirit test. So just stand there and look pretty.
Kleck's snout trembled with worry. But then he steeled himself, and the adventurer slayer replaced the scared Batlin.
Do your worst, Lord Ed, he said.
Ed gave him a thumbs up.
All right, then. Here I go.
His evil eye blazed green as he focused his will to cast Minor Order.
Jump!
Jump! Jump!
He ordered, his voice booming. The air around the dish rippled, like a stone breaking the surface of a lake. Kleck tensed. For an instant, a green gleam danced through the glass like a reflection from a candle. And then it was gone. Nothing happened.
Did you pass a spirit test?
Levy asked the Batblin. Ed shook his head at the same time Kleck did. There had been no clash of wills at all.
Yes! It worked! Damn, I can't believe we didn't blow up!
She began to cackle, caught herself, then said,
I mean, of course it worked. I knew it would. This just proves it is all.
Kleck raised an eyebrow and shuffled away from the dish.
Well done, Levy.
Ed patted the witch on the shoulder and walked closer to the copper array. He set his normal hand on the surface of the glass. It was warm, but cooling. He did the same with his skeletal hand, though he found nothing out of the ordinary. He'd hoped that the dish could store the charge of his spell, like a rune or a battery. But he suspected the haunt's research wasn't anywhere close to that yet.
Sadly, it's too large to use against magical gazes,
Levy said, full of fake humility.
But I was thinking we could use the design to improve the scrambler towers. Divination is outside my area of expertise, though, so we may have to find a diviner to help.
Great idea. We'll see if we can hire someone through the Thieves Guild.
It would have to be someone who didn't ask too many questions about having to work on a very obvious dark design, though. But it shouldn't be much of a problem. It was incredible what people failed to notice if the pay warranted it. He turned to face Levy.
If you think of any other way we can use the dish, let me know. And if you manage to solve the size problem, I was thinking we could add them to the helmet's eye slits, make the glass thicker.
Hell, if she improved the design enough, they could add a whole load of improvements to the haunt's helmets. Telescopic and night vision, illusion piercing, magic detection. At the very least, it would save those of the haunt a couple dozen experience points and talents. Levy's grin widened.
I like the way you think. I'll let you know if I come up with anything. In the meantime, I've got a few shiny new experience points to throw around.
A research mission has progressed. Lens technology. Reward? Technology. Improved scrambler towers. Requires further research. Further research may also reveal other applications. A new technological path is available. Lens technology. Miniaturization. Progress through this path to unlock design? Smart helmets. It was a well-known fact among Ivalian spellcasters that increasing your body's magical abilities using experience points had a peculiar interaction with your mind. Bardic repositories were full with reports of wizards and warlocks buying an improved spellcasting talent and experiencing the distant past, other worlds, planes, or even branching timelines for a brief minute while the ley lines of their bodies expanded. The visions were confusing and rarely had any useful meaning, despite constant attempts by diviners to use them in prophecy and scrying. Nevertheless, attempts in the other direction, to shelve the visions into a curious but useless category, also failed because of the few occasions when they actually worked. For example, Alder had told Ed of the wizard apprentice who discovered he was the last heir of a long-thought-lost royal family through his very first vision, or of the diviner who had found the location of a buried ancient city through his advanced spellcasting vision. The problem with this kind of useful vision was that there was no way to distinguish them from their random counterparts, and the long-lost heir of the throne is a common claim among usurpers who need an excuse to stage a coup. In the case of the diviner and his lost city, it was his guild who led the expedition to uncover it, only after following a completely unrelated lead, long after the original diviner had died in utter poverty and ignominy after all his peers ridiculed him for trusting a random magical hunch instead of their dusty scrolls. The wizard apprentice had been executed for trying to stage a coup against the kingdom regent, and it was only posthumously that his vision was confirmed by a couple pesky bards who uncovered a damning piece of evidence buried by the regent himself. The adventurers hired by those bards as protection led a very quick, yet bloody revolution that ended with their leader executing the regent and replacing him. Sadly, it turns out that violent murder hobos don't make for competent civil servants, and the little kingdom soon found itself in yet another peasant revolt. Only this time Haligis, its neighbor, saw a chance for an easy annexation and took it. The Haligian army marched down the little kingdom's palace, finding only token resistance, and the king executed everyone involved. And their mothers for good measure. And that was the end of that mess. This is all to say that, among the spellcasting community, random magical visions from no clear source were considered more trouble than they're worth. When Ed found himself standing in the middle of a black lake surrounded by a colossal man-made cavern, he set to learn as little as possible from this particular vision, lest it come to bite him in the ass later on. The lake extended until it reached a raised stone platform in the distance. The walls at both sides of the lake fed the waters with a constant stream coming through rusty, grated outlets, and Ed could almost feel the current raging beneath his feet. He was standing on the water without gravity, complaining, so at first he thought he was simply standing atop a shallow puddle. Then he saw the shapes far, far below, constantly changing size as they swam up and down, their figures only vaguely reminiscent of fish and even then, only of their worst qualities. As a dungeon lord, Ed had an instinctual fear of running water only a hairbreadth away from a full-blown aquaphobia. His powers were fueled by the ley lines of the ground, of warm soil and cold rock, and in the middle of a lake he was about as magical as a naked batwing facing a wolf. So he hurried as fast as he could toward the only source of solid ground that he could see, the platform several hundred meters away. He tried not to wonder what would happen if the spell that kept him walking over the water suddenly ended, and if the creatures lurking underneath would care much for details like, "You can't eat someone that's technically not here at all." Tall brass braziers at his sides lit as he went, bathing his shoulders in a kind of ultraviolet light that would have been at home in a rave back on Earth. An open tent rose in the middle of the platform, dominated by a pyramid of emerald green cushions as big as Ed, each embroidered with golden scales, bells, silk knots, and silver whistles. Lavish tables full of exotic fruits and curated meats surrounded the cushion pyramid, with one small stone table right in front of the pyramid. Languishing behind the stone table was a woman half buried in the pile of cushions, with her raven black hair cascading over her naked torso like a curtain of night. Even at a distance, Ed could tell she was beautiful beyond description, in a way that could draw the breath from a man or make bards fall weeping to their knees. As he approached, she smiled lazily, grabbed a grape the size of an aureus, and took a bite in a way that was at the same time enticing and innocent. Ed caught a glimpse of her breasts rising up with every deep breath, and could feel his throat drying, even in a vision. He distrusted her immediately. Even so, there was nowhere else to go, and he strolled almost placidly in the rhythm of a dream until he reached the platform's feet. Then he climbed a small series of steps and was face to face with the mysterious woman. Her eyes were ink black, and her irises seemed to swirl as if containing stormy clouds, the implication of thunder only faintly hidden by her full red lips. Ed stopped in front of her, finding himself unable to speak. This didn't worry him. It was just a vision, after all, and one could rarely interact with a dream. He could only wait until his mind got used to the increased magical influx. Then he'd wake up in his room, his shiny new improved spellcasting talent ready to greet him with two spells for his choosing.
Lord Wraith,
the woman greeted him with a musical voice.
At long last. I was wondering for how much longer my brother would keep me from meeting such an enthralling experiment.
She bent forward in a way that made Ed glad he didn't have a physical body at the moment, and gestured for him to sit on a small seat in front of her stone table. He did as she asked, still unable to control his movements.
You may address me as Regent Corgoron, or My Lady of Secrets, if you prefer.
Ed stared at her, unable to speak or move. Corgoron made a tall flourish with her hand, as if greeting a crowd, and a deck of golden cards appeared between her fingers out of nowhere. The deck looked heavy and metallic, with sharp edges bolted to a mercurial back that seemed to weave in the very pattern of Corgoron's eyes. With a careless smile, she shuffled the deck several times, making cards fly between her hands, then dance atop the table and jump, disappear, and reappear in Ed's hands, only to return to her grasp a second later.
The Shadow Tarot,
she revealed, as she finished her shuffle and set the deck on the center of the table, right between her and Ed.
The perfect instrument to woo an ambitious young dungeon lord in the prime of his life. It brings the gift of knowledge, my dear, of a very secret and guarded kind, too.
With a dexterous wave, she spread the deck in a perfect arc across the table.
Prophecy,
she whispered.
A magic far beyond the ken of mortal diviners, and even beyond most demon regents of the Netherworld. But between you and me, Lord Wraith? It's more useful as a bit of dining entertainment between friends. The perfect excuse to get to know each other. You shall see what I mean.
She pointed at the cards.
Pick six cards, form a triangle with three, and an inverted one with the rest, right behind the first. Go on, don't be shy.
Ed did as she asked. He selected his cards after a bit of hesitation, then ordered them in a sort of rhombus spread. Corgoron smiled and slid the first three cards back to her side of the table.
This set represents three possible futures where you fail to achieve your goals, Lord Wraith.
She turned the cards on their backs to reveal swirling windows with tiny human-shaped drawings coming in and out of frame.
Regardless of what many mortals believe, the future is not set in stone. It is fluid, like a nightshade's mist seeping through the cracks of stone, or the branches of a river carving new paths through the centuries. The Shadow Tarot is a tool to understand the present, Lord Wraith. So gaze into the cards and behold the consequences of your actions.
If he'd had control of his body, Ed would have refused, but his vision left him no room for choice. He bent forward and stared deep into the cards, and the view seemed to react to his attention and panned into a closer view. The card showed him a sunny day with no clouds, the view to the shining blue sky partially obscured by a rough wooden contraption fitted with iron restraints. A man knelt in the frame, his back painfully bent toward the floor, and was bound by his wrists and neck to the device, his face obscured by dirty patches of black hair.
A common fate among dungeon lords,
Corgoron pointed out.
Captured by the Inquisition and summarily executed.
The image shifted enough to reveal the man's face, and Ed stared at his own deformed visage. His throat tightened as he caught sight of the web of angry scars obscuring most of his features, the purple bloated skin, and the red, empty eye sockets burned away with fire irons. Corgoron waved her hands at the image as if goading it into showing more.
In this future, you refused to use lethal force against the Inquisition, arguing that they had good intentions. Although misguided, it is a courtesy our Haligian friends won't extend to us. The Inquisition poured through your dungeons, slaughtered all your minions, and captured you. At least your conscience is clean, isn't it? Although you don't seem particularly at ease with your situation, at least from this vantage point, would you agree?
The Ed in the card screamed in terror and tried to wiggle free of his restraints as the executioner entered into the frame. The real Ed recognized the man, despite the ceremonial white tunic and armor and the golden spurs hanging from his chest. Gallio didn't seem particularly happy with the situation either, but at least he had his eyes. They stared blankly at nothing in particular as he swung the sword at the beaten dungeon lord's neck. There was a spray of red, and the head rolled out of sight. Some other inquisitor came to remove the body and began the bloody process of tearing the black heart out of its chest. The vision went dark.
The only way to remove this branch of possibility from your tree is to take refuge into the netherworld, Lord Wraith,
Corgoron said, amused.
A few dungeon lords have accepted our offers, and they live comfortable lives, albeit with no further delusions of world domination. Does that interest you? Many regents would take you in if you're willing to pay their price.
The next card showed a paved street surrounded by gigantic towers of steel and crystal. It took Ed a couple seconds to realize he was staring at a city block from Earth. A disgruntled hobo stood on a wooden stool and screamed at the passing crowd, which did its best not to notice him. His nose was red with drink, his eyes injected with yellow and disease, but Ed could recognize himself even through the overgrown beard and hair.
Ah, this is one I haven't seen before,
Corgoron said with evident pleasure.
It seems that you displeased Murmur in this future, Dungeon Lord. A bad idea, and that's an understatement. The Dark Father is patient with those who amuse him, but even his patience has a limit, and he can have quite the temper once he gets going. I wonder what you did to earn his ire, though. This version of you seems to believe Murmur will invade your home plane.
Crazy homeless Ed was holding a cardboard sign. He comes, it said. The end is near. We must fight before it's too late. Trust no one. It seemed to be the source of Corgoron's assumption that Murmur had decided to invade Earth, and the real Ed saw no reason to believe otherwise. His card counterpart was trying to raise the alarm, rally the troops, and prepare some kind of defense. Obviously, people had thought him insane. On the other hand, judging by the stains of indeterminate origin on his shirt and the half-empty bottle by his feet, perhaps future Ed had gone a bit crazy.
It seems you didn't take well to being expelled from Ivalus,
Corgoron said.
That's something for that bard of yours to mull over, I'd say. Most heroes in the olden tales return to their homes after their quest is done, their adventure having changed them for the better, readying them to transform their villages in return. In your case, though, your haunt is your home. It makes you wonder if you'd fit better the role of antagonist rather than of the spunky hero in Alder's Chronicle. Don't you agree?
She laughed merrily at her own joke. Ed disliked her more and more by the minute. There was something deeply cruel about her that reminded him of Charon, although the two couldn't have been more different physically. The third card showed only a black screen. Ed and Corgoron stared at it for a while, but it didn't change. Corgoron frowned and waved her hands at it, with no results. She raised one perfectly trimmed eyebrow.
A faulty card? Even an artifact of power such as the Shadow Tarot needs a tune-up every century or so. Or this happens. My apologies, Lord Wraith. At least it's nothing to worry about. Let's say that in this branch, objectivity erases you out of the tapestry of time after earning its ire one too many times. Boring, yet possible nonetheless.
Ed had to agree with the regent on that. She stacked the three cards back into the main deck of the Shadow Tarot and turned her attention to the remaining three.
Are you feeling a little gloomy, Dungeon Lord? Watching yourself be executed or go insane can be demoralizing. But look here. In these three futures, you are triumphant. I saved them for last to erase the sour taste of your bad endings. Observe.
The first image revealed a place deep underground, panning through a never-ending maze of passageways and empty, cracked halls ravaged by a terrible battle fought long ago. Skeletons in rusty armor lay in heaps, their hands still clutching their broken weapons. The scene was lit by a magical gray-green light coming from a tall human figure roaming through the halls, passing through wall and stone as if they weren't there. This creature was covered by a tattered cloak that had been green in another lifetime, but which dried blood, gore, and murk had turned into a brownish black.
A wraith, Ed thought.
The undead seemed unaware of everything, even itself. Something told Ed that it had been wandering like this, aimlessly, for years and years. Then the creature turned back, as if to gaze directly at Ed, and Ed saw the faint, translucent layer of skin that surrounded the creature's charred skeleton, the same spectral features of Ed's cursed left hand.
Behold, the Wraith Lord roaming his haunt,
Corgoron said.
Isn't he impressive? In this future, you do move past your gripes over using lethal force against the Inquisition. After your friends and allies are killed in a raid that you barely survive. To protect what remains of your home, you abuse objectivity to its very limits, rake in thousands of experience points, and use your game knowledge to design a character sheet unlike anything modern Ivalice has seen. The Wraith Lord isn't fully undead, nor is he Dungeon Lord, nor human, yet is somehow greater than the three. His power may indeed rival that of some demon regents. Just don't tell them I said that.
She tapped the card with a fingertip.
And look! The Wraith Lord rains doom upon those that defy him.
As she spoke, the Wraith Lord walked through a wall and came to a giant hall where a group of adventurers waited for him. They weren't the inhuman heroes of the Inquisition, but real elves, humans, and dwarves. Flesh and bone. They were armed to the teeth. But their faces seemed emaciated, ashen and hopeless, as if they'd been roaming the haunt for a long time.
Just how big is that place? Ed thought.
The Wraith Lord attacked without hesitation. The adventurers defended themselves. Or tried to, at least. What followed could only be called a fight by the most lax definitions. With a flick of his wrist, the Wraith Lord sent a river of gray fire that engulfed a stout dwarven knight, ate at his defensive enchantments, and reduced him to a burned crisp all in the span of seconds. The other adventurers threw fireballs and advanced magic that Ed didn't recognize, but the spells died in the air long before they reached the Wraith Lord. Another snap of the wrist, and the room itself came alive. Pillars of stone became as flexible as snakes and fell over the elven cleric. The floor grew mouth and fangs and swallowed the thief, and statues charged at the remaining warriors. One of them, a gnome girl, lost her nerve as her companions died around her, and she dropped her scepter and ran away, backing herself into a corner in her panic. Dozens of spectral hands came out of the wall without warning, restrained her, and dragged her screaming and kicking into the stone, where she disappeared without a trace. After the third flick of his wrist, there were no adventurers alive. The air in the hall had been transmuted into acid. The Wraith Lord floated away as if nothing had happened while his dungeon corroded the corpses into nothingness.
Isn't it inspiring? Don't you wish you could do that?